Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, October 22nd. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. A brief look at the weather for today. A series of fronts account for more active weather pattern. A warm front pushed up from the south through Iowa last night, and that helped fire off our rain and isolated thunderstorms overnight. Behind that warm front, gusterly southern winds are helping to usher in warm air. That's going to help us top out well above average this afternoon in the 70s. Later today, then, our attention turns to a cold front that will bring another round of rain and a few strong thunderstorms this afternoon and evening. The cooler air behind that will quickly be noticed as highs Friday look to warm only to the 40s. High today, then, in Cedar Rapids, 73, and Iowa City, 74, and lows 38 and 39. Partly cloudy Friday and Saturday, and a chance of rain again on Sunday. Now to the front page of the Gazette this morning. A large picture is included that shows co-college students Aubrey Cota, Bryn Boderman, and Kaylin Beatty planting a tree Wednesday on the co-campus in Cedar Rapids. The campus lost more than 200 trees in the August storm. Alumni and other donors have donated 120 trees, which students, faculty, and staff are planting Wednesday and today. Co estimates its cleanup costs from the storm at $2.25 million. Also on the front page, Marion Police add mental health counselor. This story is by Kat Russell. When Tom Dobbs first started working as a cop, calls involving a mental health issue weren't nearly as common as they are now. But we still don't have many options in place as far as dealing with them, said Dobbs, public information officer for the Marion Police Department. That's why the department is working with Foundation 2 to add a crisis intervention counselor who will respond with officers on mental health calls. The Marion City Council okayed the position earlier this month with the goal of having someone hired by year's end. The Cedar Rapids Police Department started a mental health liaison program 2 years ago and has since created a mental health unit of 2 Foundation 2 liaisons, a mental health officer, and a sergeant. Foundation 2 is a Cedar Rapids-based nonprofit that offers mobile crisis services and other mental health services. Data shows 5% of the 170,455 calls the Marion Police officers fielded, that's between January 1 of 2015 and September 30 of 2020, had a mental health component such as someone in crisis, a juvenile with behavioral issues, a welfare check, or someone who was suicidal. Those calls take time to resolve, often tying up officers for hours, Dobbs said. The Marion Police Department has 46 officers with 5 to 10 officers on shift, depending on the day and time. In the past 5 years, he said Marion police officers spent nearly 8,000 hours handling mental health calls, hours they were taken off the streets, leaving a shift shorthanded. Calls involving a possible mental health issue typically require 2 officers, Dobbs said. And then it's also a matter of what it is that's driving the issue, and does the officer have the capability or the capacity or the resources available to take them someplace other than the emergency room, he said. By having a mental health liaison, that person could go and relieve that officer and sit with that patient, and we know that the patient will be comfortable and feel safe with the liaison because they will be sitting with someone who has experience working with people in similar situations and knows what to say and how to act, Dobbs said. Additionally, he said a police uniform sometimes can exacerbate a situation, further agitating the person in crisis, whereas a crisis intervention counselor who is coming in wearing plain clothes may be able to better de-escalate the situation and make more headway. The goal for the liaison program, Dobbs said, is to better help others in crisis while freeing up officers to work the streets and to reduce the number of committals and jail bookings. Emily Blum, executive director of Foundation 2, said a trained counselor can provide resources and support. What we know is that when a trained counselor can show up with the support of a mobile crisis team and do that de-escalation on site, do that suicide screening and assessment if need be, we can reduce the number of jail admissions and reduce the number of hospitalizations. And the corresponder model allows us to do that more effectively, she said. Marion Police are the second agency in the area to add a crisis intervention counselor, but Blum said other agencies, including the Linn County Sheriff's Office, are investigating similar programs. It's that co-responder model that I think really makes this program so effective, because it is not only expanding the reach of our mobile crisis resources, but what we also see is that officers learn more. Perspectives change. The culture of the department is modified and improved, and that's because they're exposed to watching someone do the work day in and day out. Also on the front page, COVID-19 patients and deaths hit Iowa highs. This story's by Vanessa Miller. More patients were being treated for COVID-19 in Iowa hospitals, and more people in the state died from the disease in a 24-hour period ending Wednesday than since the novel coronavirus was confirmed here over 7 months ago. The surge in hospitalizations in Iowa and several other states is troubling to public health officials, not only because it raises concerns over the availability of beds and equipment, but because a rising number of patients indicates mitigation efforts are lacking. Iowa set a record of 534 hospitalizations in a 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Wednesday. That eclipsed a record set in the 24-hour period just the day before. In addition, Iowa public health officials reported a record 32 deaths in the 24-hour period, with deaths spanning 20 counties, including Linn. Moreover, Iowa's positivity rate, the percentage of people tested for the infection who proved positive, worsened during the 24-hour period, hitting 21.61%. A horrific day in Iowa from coronavirus. Please mourn the dead, care for the sick, support loved ones and caregivers, and help stop the spread, tweeted State Senator Rob Hogg, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. Unionized University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics workers issued a joint statement Wednesday calling on local and state leaders to make battling the pandemic their top priority. Iowa marked a grim milestone yesterday, according to the statement from AFSCME Local 12, representing 2,000 plus UIHC workers and SEIU Local 199, which represents about 4,000 UIHC nurses and other healthcare professionals. For the first time since the coronavirus hit our state, more than 500 patients were in Iowa hospitals being treated for COVID-19, they said in the statement. Our members at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics have seen firsthand the devastation this illness can cost. Of these hospitalized in the period, 134 COVID-19 patients were in intensive care, up from 122, and 4 more patients were on ventilators to help breathe, an increase to 49 from 45. While the number of COVID-19 patients set records for 2 consecutive days, the rise of those in intensive care and on ventilators did not set records. The state said Iowa hospitals still had 370 ICU beds and 786 ventilators available as of Wednesday. In their statement, UI healthcare workers highlighted the growing tally of UIHC employees who have tested positive, 637 to date, including 4 who were added Tuesday. We and all workers on the front lines of the fight against COVID need Iowa's leaders to step up and provide the personal protective equipment and the resources necessary for us to care for Iowa, the statement said. UIHC on Wednesday reported having 23 adult COVID-19 patients and caring for a total of 621 since the pandemic arrived in Iowa in March. It doesn't currently have any pediatric patients, although it has admitted 32 coronavirus patients under the age of 18 so far. UIHC has screened patients for COVID-19 over 52,891 video and telephone visits to date, including 336 on Tuesday. It's tabulated a total of 64,759 visits to its influenza-like illness clinic, which it built in the spring in response to COVID-19, including 546 on Tuesday. The UIHC employees cited a state audit this week. Funding that Governor Kim Reynolds wrongly directed $20 million of federal coronavirus aid to a state computer system. The state auditor and a federal inspector general both said the expenditure was not allowed, but Reynolds said Wednesday she would try to convince them it was proper. If still not allowed, the money would need to be refunded or redeployed. "We need those funds for patients, not computers," the unionized UIHC employees wrote. "Together, we're calling on Governor Reynolds and every elected official in Iowa to promise that they will make the lives of Iowa's patients number one." In total, Iowa added 1,300 new COVID-19 cases in the 24-hour period, bringing its total to 109,634. Linn County reported 74 new cases, the second highest 24-hour tally since the start, bringing its case total to 5,133. Johnson County, home to the UI, added 20 cases, bringing its total to 5,669. Story County, home to Iowa State University, added 18 for a total of 3,879, and Black Hawk County, home to the University of Northern Iowa, added 73 for a total of 5,283. Among children up to age 17, Iowa added 136 cases Wednesday, bringing that total to 9,572. Moving to the Iowa Today page, Clearing the Path, this story by Gage Miskeman. Removal of the former railroad bridge above Marion Boulevard is moving along. The construction is part of the future CMAR Trail project, which will provide a trail system connecting uptown Marion to downtown Cedar Rapids, providing more than 7 miles of paved trail for walkers, runners, and bicyclists. The removal of the old bridge is phase three of the project's five-phase process. The project will close that section of Marion Boulevard from 7 p.m. October 26 to 6 a.m. October 27 to remove the center pier, according to Marion Communications Manager Amber Bissinger. When that is done, crews will replace the center median. The remaining work is expected to take a couple of weeks, Bissinger said. One lane will be maintained in each direction of the street during the process. Construction of a new pedestrian bridge spanning Marion Boulevard is expected to begin next summer. Local artist Kara Briggs, farmer, and Synergy Metalworkers were selected to design the gateway features for a new bridge. And the photo that's included shows workers with Peterson Contractors of Rhinebeck using breakers to separate concrete from rebar as demolition continues Wednesday on supports of a former railroad bridge over Marion Boulevard. A pedestrian bridge will be built in its place. Also in the Iowa Today news, a teen accused of a Gucci belt robbery outside a Cedar Rapids school. This story is by Kat Russell. Police arrested an 18-year-old Tuesday and charged him with robbing a 17-year-old who was selling a belt at Kennedy High School. Cedar Rapids police said Cortez Jacoby Riggins Jr. of Ely met the 17-year-old boy at 10:30 p.m. Tuesday in the parking lot at Kennedy High School on Wenig Road Northeast. Police said Riggins had arranged online to buy a belt from the teen for $150. When the two met, police said Riggins gestured like he had a gun, causing the 17-year-old to fear for his safety. Then, police said Riggins took the belt without paying and drove off. A description of the vehicle was broadcast to officers who spotted it a short time later. Officers stopped Riggins at 29th Street and Edgewood Road Northwest. The Gucci belt belonged to the 17-year-old and was inside the vehicle, police said. Riggins was charged with second-degree robbery. He also had an active warrant charging him with failure to appear in a possession of drug paraphernalia case. And from Clear Lake, this story by Ashley Stewart, a fall tradition started by Cheryl Pinkham on Clear Lake has received a new face, a colorful contest. The face, one of a jack-o'-lantern, was painted this month. Brothers Xander Medlin, age 5, with Bellamy North, age 2, of Mason City, took turns painting the pumpkin, including its eyes, nose, and mouth, at the base of a tall pine tree outside Pinkham's home. "They did a good job," she told the Mason City Globe Gazette. The boys' names were drawn from a bucket October 1st after Pinkham shared a post on Facebook asking parents to enter their children into a contest to have the opportunity to give her pumpkin tree a facelift before Halloween. Their mother, Amy Medellin, was among almost 20 parents who responded to the post within the 5-day window. "I just thought it would be really cool, fun idea for the boys," she said. Pinkham and her daughter, Caitlin, have been painting a jack-o'-lantern at the base of the tree since 2005 when they bought the lot. When we were exploring the lot, my daughter and I looked at it and said, "That looks like a pumpkin in the tree," so we decided we were going to paint it from then on, Pinkham said. Pinkham said Caitlin was responsible for the faces on the pumpkin until she graduated high school in 2018. Pinkham painted the tree in 2018 and 2019. "It's usually done just before Halloween," she said. Pinkham said she decided to create a contest to paint the tree and give children something to look forward to and smile about. Amy Medlin said her sons were excited to have the chance to paint the tree. She and her boyfriend Zach North got to Pinkham's house with the boys just before 4 p.m., and within minutes, Xander Medlin was spray-painting last year's faded pumpkin on the tree, neon orange. The whole project took less than 20 minutes for the boys to complete. Pinkham rewarded the boys with their individual goodie bags, stuffed with a little bit of everything, including candy and toys. The boys' jack-o'-lantern will be on the tree until next year, when Pinkham hosts a new contest to give more children the opportunity to paint. And also on the Iowa Today page, Mid-American idles 46 wind turbines. Iowa-based electric utility Mid-American Energy has idled nearly 4 dozen power-generating wind turbines after huge blades broke off 2 turbines in recent weeks. Mid-American has paused the use of 46 turbines it has identified as having similar blades, which are about 177 feet long and weigh 18,000 pounds, the Des Moines Register reported. The company acknowledged that one blade on a turbine near Peyton fell Thursday into an empty field. In mid-September, another blade on a turbine near Adel crashed into a cornfield. Similar incidents were reported in April and in October 2019 at Adair County wind farms. No one was hurt. Mid-American has isolated the issue to blades made by Danish manufacturer Vestas and is working with Vestas Mid-American spokesman Jeff Greenwood. In each case, data show lightning strikes occurred close to the turbines, Mid-America said, with the blades in the earliest 2 failures taking direct hits. The failed blades all had the same lightning protection system, which is designed to channel the energy from nearby strikes safely into the ground. Though a blade failure remains an extremely rare occurrence, even one incident is not acceptable, which is why we've immediately enacted these additional precautions. Moving to the Insight page, the editorial today is a Washington Post reprint, Bad Actors in Disguise. The collapse of the local news industry offers manipulators a motherlode of opportunity, a populace full of questions, and a gaping hole where they used to go for answers. A network of nearly 1,300 websites discovered by the New York Times is the latest example of bad actors exploiting the void. The sites described in this week's report, now in all 50 states, look like an old local news outlet with names such as Maine Business Daily and Illinois Valley Times. Yet despite a note in most of their about pages promising to provide objective, data-driven information without political bias, they aren't really offering reporting, they're offering propaganda. a mishmash of conservative political operatives, public relations professionals, and think tanks act as clients for the sites, paying freelancers to prop up Republican candidates and knock down Democratic competitors. Sometimes they're even instructed on precisely what to say by an article subject. The story elucidates an existing trend by hyperpartisan outfits masquerading as local news, cloaking themselves in journalistic credibility while really churning out smears. A Nieman Lab study found more than 400 such sites this summer, 8 of them liberal. The Wall Street Journal on Monday further reported on this left-leaning effort, backed largely by the nonprofit acronym. The Times investigation is notable for revealing not only the startling size of the network it identifies, but also its pernicious pay-to-play nature, wherein writers are commissioned to write specific stories to influence elections. The tactic is reminiscent of a strategy recently popular among Russian meddlers known as narrative laundering, hiring unwitting freelancers located in target countries to produce content that citizens are more likely to consume uncritically. The phenomenon of disguised political sites is enabled by fuzzy campaign finance regulations that make it difficult even to find out where the money is coming from, and by the depletion of community newspapers, 2,100 of which have closed across the country since 2004 as advertising revenue has dried up. Proposals to restore what was once a pillar of American democracy vary from beefing up philanthropy to harnessing taxpayer dollars to extracting revenue from technology companies such as Google and Facebook. These solutions have their advantages and their drawbacks, including threats to editorial independence. Yet something must be done. It has long been clear that the vacuum in local journalism means less knowledge, less accountability, and probably more polarization. Now it also is clear that the vacuum won't stay a vacuum. Someone else will fill it, and not with real journalism that communities across the country so keenly need. And again, that was a reprint of the editorial from the Washington Post. In the 24-hour Doorman column is "The Battle of Ideas Has Gone Dark." Our top candidates for the U.S. Senate are fighting over dark money. Who takes it? Who colludes with it, and who is the bigger hypocrite? Sure, money from undisclosed donors is a problem, but so is the spending happening out in the open, but out of the view of most voters. Consider Plains PAC, a Kansas-based super PAC most famous for helping take down Kris Kobuk in the GOP Senate primary in Kansas. But since September, Plains PAC has spent more than $10 million on the Iowa Senate race, mostly on media buys attacking Democrat nominee Teresa Greenfield. Plains PAC is funded by another conservative super PAC, Senate Leadership Fund, which already has spent more than $23 million boosting GOP Senator Joni Ernst and attacking Greenfield. Senate Leadership Fund is bankrolled by a list of very wealthy donors. Las Vegas casino magnate Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam have donated $50 million. There's Timothy Mellon, founder of a freight and rail company, who donated $20 million. In his autobiography, he wrote that black Americans, quote, became more belligerent, end quote, with the expansion of the social safety net, and that people who rely on those programs are, quote, slaves of a new master, Uncle Sam, end quote. Steven Schwarzman, chairman and CEO of Blackstone, a private equity firm, chipped in $20 million. Former casino magnate Steve Wynn, who stepped down as CEO of Wynn Resorts amid a series of sexual misconduct allegations, contributed $4 million. Plains PAC is paying for an ad accusing Greenfield of backing a government-run healthcare scheme that would risk the closure of 52 rural hospitals in Iowa, citing a September 2019 Gazette story. It also argues the plan would jeopardize employer-based insurance, citing a New York Times piece. As the Gazette makes clear, the closed hospital estimate comes from the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, a coalition of pharmaceutical, insurance, and hospital lobbyists opposed to any expansion of Medicare to cover uninsured Americans. The Times piece says if a new public health insurance option is inexpensive and attractive, it could shake up the private market. So a sketchy Kansas super PAC is using money from another super PAC, bankrolled by guys rich enough to be Bond villains, to pay for ads touting a study panning expanded health care conducted by a bunch of lobbyists who oppose expanded health care. But it's okay because it's being done independently at arm's length from the candidates. The Democrats' plan, which would eventually lead us to Medicare for all, would actually bankrupt about 52 of our rural health care systems, Ernst said in a September debate. Greenfield does favor adding a public option to the Affordable Care Act, which would raise questions about reimbursements for rural hospitals. Ernst has called for a federal backstop for people with pre-existing conditions, but hasn't explained what that means. The GOP is trying to bury the ACA, but has no alternative plan. Any real discussion of these issues is drowned out by attack lines amplified by outsiders with fat checkbooks. The battle of ideas had been called off because of darkness. And again, that's Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column. One community letter today, Amy Coney Barrett is not looking out for women. This is submitted by Ashley Burns from Cedar Rapids. If affirmed as a U.S. Supreme Court justice, women would be most harmed by Amy Coney Barrett's positions regarding health care. Based on her writings, it is all but certain that if appointed, Barrett would be the deciding vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. This would be especially harmful to women. Before the ACA, women could be charged more than men for the same coverage. In fact, women often were charged up to 50% higher. Before the ACA, 75% of non-group plans did not cover delivery and inpatient maternity care. The Trump administration and allies such as Senator Joni Ernst advocate for policies such as short-term and association health plans that are not required to cover essential health benefits. A repeal of the ACA and the implementation of these short-term plans would force women to pay out-of-pocket expenses to cover childbirth. We know that for many, these costs will cause serious financial burdens. The ACA guarantees that women may access copay-free contraception. If the ACA were to be repealed, this also could go away. This and the Republicans' war on Planned Parenthood means even higher barriers for acquiring health care, especially for women in minority groups and middle to low-income brackets. Despite both being women, Ernst and Barrett are no friends to Iowa's women, and Barrett confirmation would have serious implications for the future of Iowa's women and health care. Again, that is submitted by Ashley Burns from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on today, Thursday, October 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices, from Blairstown, Patricia Ann Rotter. Excuse me, that's the index for the more lengthy notices. And in the other notices, here we go. In Cedar Rapids, Elaine J. Corrigan, age 84, died Wednesday, October 21st. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting. Also in Cedar Rapids, David Lyman, age 60, died Sunday, October 18th. Iowa Cremation in Cedar Rapids is in charge. Also in Cedar Rapids, Marcus A. White, age 94, died Wednesday, October 21st. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. From Claremont, Reuben Steffens, age 96, died Monday, October 19th. The Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Claremont, is in charge. And in Farmersburg, Cheryl Scherf, age 85, died Wednesday, October 21st. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester, is in charge of arrangements. In Harper's Ferry, Constance, known as Connie T. Lester, age 92, died Monday, October 19th. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is in charge. From Ossian, Francis Wenthold, age 88, died Wednesday, October 21st. Schmitz Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Ossian is in charge. In Sigourney, Pat Shannon, age 86, died Tuesday, October 20th. The Home Funeral Home in Sigourney is in charge. And in Tama, Helen Louise Brezina, age 87, died Monday, October 19th. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo, is assisting. In Waukon, Ann A. Gallagher, age 70, of Waukon, formerly of Lansing, died Tuesday, October 20th. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is in charge. And in West Liberty, Mary Joan Phobian Mead, age 85, died Monday, October 19th. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is assisting. And now moving on to the longer notices. From Blairstown, Patricia Ann Rotter, age 79, passed away on Tuesday, October 20th at Northbrook Manor in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, October 26th at the Phillips Funeral Home in Blairstown. Interment will be held at Pleasant Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time on Monday at the funeral home. From Monticello, James Kibbers, age 79, died on Tuesday, October 20th at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center. A public visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd at the Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. Private family services will follow. Masks must be worn and properly fitted over the nose and mouth at all times. From Cedar Rapids, Nancy E. Meineke McQuaid passed away, and information about her services, burial will be in the Green Center Cemetery near Morley, and there will be a visitation from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday at the State Room at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. From Independence, Frank R. Brimmer, age 90, died on October 18th at the Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Visitation is from 6 to 8 p.m., October 23rd, also from 1 to 3, and 6 to 8 on October 24th at the White Funeral Home in Independence. Graveside services will be at 1 p.m. October 25th at St. John's Cemetery, Independence. From Cedar Rapids, Kenneth R. Ruzica, age 74, died Monday, October 19th at the Hiawatha Care Center. Private family services at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Entombment will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Mausoleum. There will be a visitation from 2 to 4 Sunday at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. The service will be live streamed at 11 a.m. Monday, October 26th. Contact Cedar Memorial for the information on how to view that service on live stream. From Marion, Gisela Hundorf, age 91, passed away Tuesday, October 20th. At the Hiawatha Care Center, a private family graveside service will be held at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. From Hiawatha, George Kramer, age 85, passed away Friday, October 16th. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 24th at First Assembly of God with visitation starting at 10 a.m. Private burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Manchester, William, known as Bill Joseph Brunsman, age 85, passed away Tuesday, October 20th at Regional Medical Center of COVID-19. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, October 22nd at the Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home, Manchester. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, October 23 at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Burial will take place at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery, Manchester, at a later date. From Cedar Rapids, Randy Chappell, age 68, passed away Tuesday at the Oldorf Hospice House after a brief illness. A private service will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be from 3 to 4 p.m. Monday, October 26th at the chapel. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Seattle, Scott David Kralik died August 9th in Seattle at the age of 63. No funeral arrangements are included with that announcement. From Manchester, Lou E. Christensen, age 84, died Tuesday, October 20th Because of COVID-19, there will be no services or visitation at this time. And finally, from Cedar Rapids, Dr. G. L. Schmidt passed away, and services will be live streamed at 3 p.m. Saturday, October 24th, and may be viewed at client.tribucast.com/TCID, followed by several numbers. The Cedar Memorial Funeral Home is handling arrangements for Dr. Schmidt. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, October 23, at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home, with a rosary at 4 p.m. Moving to the sports page, lots of high school sports to report today. First, in cross country, the Lions raced to 4A qualifier title. They advanced. In fact, they won. Have they peaked? The Linmar Lions hope not. We've struggled a little with injuries. Close, Gidmore said. It's been different people with different things that have inhibited our true performance. We had a good race today, and we hope we have a better one next week. Led by individual runner-up Micah Pollitt, Linmar won the girls' team title at Wednesday's Class 4A cross-country state qualifying meet at the Dubuque Soccer Complex. With four runners in the top 15, the Lions accumulated 58 points. Dubuque Senior had 68 and Dubuque Hempstead had 74. The top three teams and top 15 individuals advanced to the state meet October 30th at Lakeside Golf Course, Fort Dodge. Our fourth and fifth girls had a great race, Pollitt said. We had five runners under 20 minutes, and the other two were really close. Pollitt was the individual state champion as a sophomore in 2018 and ran fourth last year. She came into Thursday's race ranked number two and led through the first 2 miles before Hempstead freshman Keely Leitzen, ranked third, passed her. Leitzen finished in 17:56. Pollitt in 1809. I try to get out fast and hold that, and today it didn't quite work, Pollitt said. Skidmore was 9th, Sarah Murphy 13th, and Lily Geelan 14th. Led by individual champion Ryan Winger, who finished in 15:28 and built a 40-second winning margin, Hempstead owned the boys' race. The Mustangs placed four runners in the top nine and crafted a 32-point total. Iowa City West edged Iowa City High for second, 66 and 71, with both qualifying easily. West's Alex McCain was third at 16:10. I've had a little bit of joint injury in my back and hip, and I've been doing a lot of cross-training and physical therapy, McCain said. I felt really good out there. This race, the goal was to qualify, not to do anything extraordinary. I took a week and a half off, so being on a short week, I'm really happy. West and City both had three runners in the top 15. Ford Washburn's seventh place effort placed the Little Hawks. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Bethany Smead, at eighth, qualified individually in the girls' race, and so did City High's Rowan Bolter, at 10th, and Lily Reynolds, at 15th. Also in sports, CCA's Barker siblings have a strong day. Both the Solon boys and girls cross-country teams qualified for the state meet next week in Fort Dodge after the boys won their Class 3A state qualifying meet and the girls clinched a spot with their third-place finish. That was thanks to all seven individual runners finishing from 10th to 20th place. Dubuque Wallert's senior duo of Gabby Moran and Alex Oliver crossed 1 and 2 with times of 1853 and 1909, respectively, before Clear Creek Amana's Hayden Barker became the top area qualifier with a time of 1913. That sent the sophomore back to the state meet. The quiet leader was determined to improve her position against rival Solon after finishing behind several Spartans at conference last week. When she finished at the WAMAC meet and had lost to Solon, one of the first things she said when I asked how she felt was, "Tired, but I could have beat Solon." Clippers assistant coach Paige O'Brien said, "She's the kind of girl that is made of very few words, but you can just tell that she has this fire and competitiveness within her." Another major supporter of Barker is older brother Brandon, a senior at CCA who himself qualified as an individual, by winning the boys' race with a time of 16:17. The Clippers finished fourth in the team standings behind Solon, West Delaware, and Wallert. A four-time state qualifier, Brandon has been a bit of a surprise in a family full of runners. "Running has always been a big part of my family," Brandon said. "I was always the worst when I was younger. They would all win their age category, and my older sister Kaylee would win the whole race, and I would win nothing. I might win a door prize if I was lucky. Going into seventh grade, my parents didn't even buy me spikes," he joked. "I wasn't expected to be anything, but by the end of the year, I came in second at middle school state, and then I won it in eighth grade." Now, Brandon hopes to improve on his podium placement at the big race after finishing in the top 15 as a junior. "If I could crack the top 8 to 10, that'd be really awesome," Brandon said. As for his sister, "She definitely has the ability to medal too," Brandon said with confidence. "I just want to see her run a good race and hopefully get a medal." And in volleyball, here is a preview by Jeff Linder. They've won a lot of matches, earned a lot of honors. They are the most decorated senior class in program history. Tonight, they begin their final volleyball postseason together, aiming to cement their legacy with a championship. "I don't think they've accomplished everything they want," Cedar Rapids Xavier coach Austin Feiler said. "They've helped take Xavier to some great spots. They hold a lot of our school records, but they still have their eyes on something bigger." The first step for the top-ranked Saints, with 21-6, isn't exactly a gimme. They welcome number 14 Pella, with a 23-11 record, to Ron Tillen Gymnasium for a 7 p.m. match. "It's not a typical first-round opponent," Feiler said, "but I think we're prepared. We've seen everybody we could see, played everybody that would play us." Seven seniors are on the Xavier varsity roster, and three of them have made an impact for 4 years. The team ledger includes a 4-year record of 113-26 with 3 state appearances, including a semifinal trip in 2017 and a run to the finals in 2018. And in a swimming story, resilient Kennedy, ranked number 7, stays unbeat and wins. This story's by Mike Condon. On the surface, it might not look like the greatest year for girls swimming at Cedar Rapids Kennedy. The Cougars have been on the road all year for meets and practices after the storm that ravaged Cedar Rapids badly damaged the Kennedy pool. A check of the state's top times doesn't show one Cougar swimmer or diver ranked higher than 15th. A deeper dive, no pun intended, shows a much different view of Coach Chad Durlian's team. The Cougars are 6-1 in dual meets, the only loss coming to Cedar Falls in the season opener. They won the Muscatine Invitational and were second at the Ram Relays in Dubuque, and their own Cougar Invitational held last month at the Linmar Aquatic Center. With one dual meet at home, in quotes, against Muscatine next Tuesday in the Washington pool, the Cougars will look to maintain the momentum that has them ranked number 7 in the state's latest power rankings. Kennedy boasts a young roster that has blended well together from the start. If you're looking for sports of interest on the radio today, in the NFL, the Giants are at the Eagles. That game's at 7 p.m. Moving now to the Livings page, say hello to High Tea. This story is by Allison Gowans. At High Tea in Cedar Rapids, owner Jennifer Doherty and her daughter Lola Lou want to share two things: delicious tea and desserts and a bit of Chinese culture. "We wanted to bring the diversity from our culture to Cedar Rapids," Lou said. "The bubble tea business in China is very popular." High Tea serves fruit teas and milk teas, served with tapioca pearls at the bottom. The drinks are also called bubble tea or boba tea. "I think it's good tea for the people," Doherty said, extolling the health benefits of drinking tea. "If you drink tea, you will live long years." The shop also serves cheese mousse tea, which is cold tea topped with a foamy cream cheese and milk layer, a popular drink in China and nearby countries. High Tea also serves hot tea and coffee. "It's so delicious, and it's an enjoyable environment to have friends in conversation and have tea time," Lou said. "It's something we can give back to the community." The cafe also offers rolled ice cream. Prepared on a freezing slab, the ice cream is rolled into cylinders that are nestled in a dish and served topped with fruit, chocolate, or other toppings. The style of ice cream started in Thailand and has gained popularity in the United States. The newest addition to the menu is a freshly made waffle served rolled in a dish with ice cream and toppings in the middle. Glu, who now lives in Orlando, Florida, helped Doherty open the shop in May 2019. Doherty worked in a friend's bubble tea shop for 6 months to learn the ins and outs of the business before they opened High Tea. Less than a year after opening, they had to close during the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The doors were shut for 3 months, which Lou said was a blow. Because we're serving cold drinks, it's very popular during the summer, so it was a pretty big hit to lose that time. Our main sales are March to August, she said. Thankfully, the cafe didn't have any derecho damage beyond some water coming in under the front door. Hanging Edison bulbs light the space, with a board plastered with colorful post-it notes on one wall. On it, customers and friends have written notes, signed their names, or left drawings of characters of their favorite boba tea. The first year was slow, but this year we have a lot of people coming in, Doherty said. When we reopened, people thanked us. That's her favorite part of the business, she said, seeing people enjoy the tea. When customers are here, I'm happy, she said. We want to bring diversity from our culture to Cedar Rapids. The bubble tea business in China is very popular. And if you go, High Tea is located at 5472 Blair's Forest Way, northeast in Cedar Rapids. And again, their hours are 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday to Thursday, and 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. For details, you can call the store at 319-651-1221. Also on the living page, Chew on This. Feedwell Kitchen and Bakery opens in Cedar Rapids. Your Pie Pizzeria is open in Marion. The story by Allison Gowans. A new cafe and bakery is open at 560 Boyson Road Northeast, Cedar Rapids. Melanie Abu Name and Holly Irvin opened Feedwell Kitchen and Bakery October 16th. Serving sandwiches, salads, soups, and freshly baked pastries and breads, the cafe is open from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday to Thursday, and from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday and Sunday. Abu Name was executive chef and food and beverage director at the hotel at Kirkwood Center, has 16 years experience as a culinary instructor with Kirkwood Community College, and has a private chef and culinary consulting business through withchefmel.com. She is leading the savory side of the kitchen, with Irvin leading the bakery side. The restaurant is online at feedwellkitchenandbakery.com, and you can reach them by dialing 319-409-6905. And Your Pie, Marion, has a new pizza place. Rory Kelly opened the Georgia-based franchise after previously opening locations in Davenport and Dubuque. The restaurant at 2791 7th Avenue opened just 3 days before the August derecho, then had to briefly close again. Your Pie focuses on fast, casual pizza, Kelly said, serving 10-inch personal pizzas built in front of the customer and cooked on the spot. They offer dine-in, carry-out, and online ordering with a curbside pickup option or delivery through DoorDash and Uber Eats. It is online at yourpie.com/stores/Marion. You can reach them by dialing 319-377-5367. Marion is a pretty up-and-coming area. It has the small-town feel, but there's still a little hustle and bustle, Kelly said. And also in the living section, get ready for the holidays with Czech Cooking Series. The National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library and Chef Tom Slepica will offer traditional Czech holiday cooking classes online as part of the Immigrant Foodway series. Lessons will include Lynn's Tarts and Ischel's Cookies from 6 to 8:30 p.m. November 4th, Mini Walnut Rolls and Mini Nests with Almonds from 6 to 8:30 p.m. On November 18th, May Beetle Cookies are from 6 to 9 p.m. On November 23rd, Pea Soup and Schnitzel with Potato Salad is scheduled from 2:30 to 6 p.m. On December 15th, Banaka, a Czech sweet bread, and from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. on December 12th. Classes are $20 for NCSML members and $25 for non-members. Members who register for the whole series will pay $90, non-members $115. Register at ncsml.org. After registration, participants will receive a confirmation email containing information about how to access the class. Participants will need high-speed internet and a computer, tablet, or smartphone to access the course. A webcam and microphone is needed to interact with Celepica. Shopping lists and recipes will be emailed at least a week before each class so participants can purchase the ingredients necessary. That does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. It's Thursday, October 22nd. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access the recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Have a good, safe day.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.